This is your program, Moscow Mailbag. It's mailbag time again, and here's Joe Adamov to answer your questions. The first letter today comes from Dan Gendron of West Warwick, Rhode Island. What will happen if the SALT II is rejected here in the United States?
Well, very unpleasant things will happen. It's something I'm sure that the absolute majority of people in your country do not want, and certainly nobody wants it to happen in my country. There'll be the loss of the most elementary trust between us, and I'm afraid we'll go back to the dark days of the Cold War. There'll be the continuation of an unbridled arms race that'll cost billions. Incidentally, did you know that the world spends $1 billion a day on arms? As if inflation isn't enough in the West, or that you haven't had enough of it? Then what will happen? New monstrous weapons and weapon systems will be developed, and certainly the danger of a nuclear holocaust will be much greater than it is now. Not to mention the fact there'll be a general worsening of the international situation. So I think it is absolutely in the interests of your people, no less than it is of ours, to see that SALT II is ratified.
And now we have a question from Carl Borg of Miami, Florida. Is there a station in the Soviet Union that broadcasts time signals?
There's no special station that broadcasts nothing but time or the weather. Of course, in Moscow, you can dial any time of the day and night, dial 100, and you'll get the exact time. But our home service stations regularly give the time signal, you know, 5 bips, like bip, bip, bip. They give that almost every hour. Then on television, for instance, before the nightly news program, which we'll call Vremya, which is the Russian for time, goes on the air, you see a big clock and a second hand which gives the exact time. Then very often when the announcer announces something in between the programs, you see a light-emitting diode clock giving you the exact time down to the seconds. That sort of thing we do have.
In the Soviet Union, is there an upper, middle, and lower income bracket?
Well, you know, we don't officially separate people or divide people into these three brackets, but I suppose you could if you wanted to, because, well, if you were to analyze incomes, I suppose you'd say that perhaps the bookkeeper in a condominium would be in the lower paid bracket, so would a cleaning woman, say, in the office. A worker at the lathe most probably would be in the middle income bracket, and say a worker like a coal miner, or maybe even a cotton picker. Yes, and a journalist would be in the higher paid bracket. That, yes. Mind you, we are equal before the law, and we have equal opportunities, but certainly no one has ever said that under socialism we would be all equal as far as pay is concerned. That is the goal to which we're working, but that is something that certainly which we have not achieved as yet. We pay today according to the quality and quantity of work done, and the difference in pay between one worker or one employee and the other may be 2, 3, and even 4 times greater. You get paid more in jobs that are scarce, or more in jobs that are very much needed by the economy, or you get more in remote areas of the country.
How does one get into the upper income bracket?
If you ever become a Soviet citizen and come to live in the Soviet Union, I'll give you all the know-how and brief you in great detail on the subject. Well, how do you, seriously speaking, get into the higher paid bracket? Well, first of all, the simplest way is to raise your skill. We have free courses at all the major enterprises. You can go to a college. I don't have to tell you that's free, too. To get into a college, all you need is to pass competitive entrance exams. Or while working, you can attend evening college or correspondence courses. You can switch over into higher paid jobs. All the roads are open, and when I say that, I mean it. Well, if you're, say, in research, you can work for a degree, and we have what we call a candidate's degree. That's roughly equivalent to your PhD. We also have a doctor's degree, which you have no equal, because you have to do quite a lot to get a doctor's degree, very, very much more, and I mean it, than you would to get a PhD. You can work your way up if you're on the job, from the simple rank-and-file worker to head of a brigade, to shop superintendent, to chief engineer, and, president of the enterprise. These are not empty words, because 7 out of every 10 cabinet ministers in the Soviet Union today began their career as just ordinary rank-and-file workers on the job. Mind you, another thing that's very interesting, higher pay doesn't always go with a top job. For instance, this is off the record, a news analyst here at Radio Moscow will earn more than, say, the editor-in-chief. Or, for instance, a coal miner at a coal mine may earn more than the head of that particular mine. So you see, there's quite a lot to it.
And now a question from Russell Gill of Kalamazoo, Michigan. Where do you in the USSR get money to run the country if no one pays tax?
Well, we do pay taxes, but the sum that we pay percentage-wise is, much smaller than what you pay. The maximum that we pay is 13%. Then pensioners don't pay any taxes. Students and vocational and technical college students, or technical school students rather, do not pay taxes, and we will gradually abolish them altogether. Taxes on wage and salary earners here make up no more than about 8 or 9% of the revenues in our state budget. You may ask, where does the money come from? Well, it comes from the incomes from state-owned or public-owned economy. Mind you, we don't have any Westinghouses or General Motors or Lockheeds. It's all publicly owned, so the state gets the income. But the income goes, again, to better the living standards of, Ivan the citizen, in one way or another. By very cheap housing, through, say, medical services, free education, and so on. He benefits from the incomes that the state makes. In fact, official figures tell us that 3/4 of the national income goes in one way or another to benefit the average citizen.
Here's a letter from Canada. Tony Amateur of Starbuck, Manitoba, wants to know, is there religious freedom in the Soviet Union?
Yes, there certainly is. If you want to go to church, or if you yourself want to teach your children religion, you're absolutely free to do so. As I've said on many occasions, if you want to baptize your children, if you want to get married in church, there are no obstacles whatsoever to that. Mind you, constitutionally, in the Soviet Union, the church is separated from the state. That means the church does not participate in any political activity. We have heard in the West many times people that have come from the Soviet Union, former dissidents, trying to prove to the people or the mass media in the West that they were persecuted for their religious beliefs. You can take it from me, as a person that's lived all his life in the Soviet Union, that no one has ever in the Soviet Union been persecuted for his religious beliefs. Now, you may ask, what are these people talking about? I will explain to you. You see, they use religion as a screed for their political activity. If a person preaches a certain type of religion or cult where he does not allow his children, for instance, to go to school, he agitates or tells servicemen not to serve in the army, or he tells young people not to go serve in the army when service in the army is compulsory, that is going against the law, that is against the laws of the country. Then they're in for some trouble. But no one, I will repeat again, has ever been prosecuted or persecuted for his religious beliefs or for going to church or for believing in God.
Is a person considered innocent until proven guilty?
Yes, he is. There is, in our Soviet legislative system, the presumption of innocence. This is one of the pillars of our legislative system. Any lawyer in the Soviet Union knows that if there is no proof, if there is no evidence, there is no crime, there is no criminal. A defendant in the Soviet Union can refuse to give evidence, and he's not held responsible for it. The court has to prove him guilty, if it can. And what's more, under Soviet law, a defendant is not held criminally responsible for false evidence, whereas a witness is. Of course, there are cases when a defendant, who is absolutely innocent, would want to shield his relatives, to shield his friends, and take the guilt upon himself. And even if he admits his guilt, that is not enough. The court, through evidence, through witnesses, has to prove him guilty. There has to be 100% proof of his guilt. The fact that he's admitted himself guilty is absolutely not enough in Soviet courts.
Can a civilian be tried by a military court?
No, he cannot. Of course, there's an exception. In cases where a civilian has committed a crime together with, say, a group of servicemen, say, four servicemen and one civilian, if they commit a crime together, then they'll all be tried in a military court, but not otherwise. The only exception are foreigners or those without citizenship. If they engage in espionage, then they're tried by a military court.
Now we have a letter from Cheryl Crowley's of Stamford, Connecticut. She writes, people in America can't help getting the idea that all these communists are stockpiling these awful weapons and just waiting for a big enough margin of safety until they can make everything go bang in one atomic blitzkrieg. I'd like to know, what is your thinking behind making all kinds of bombs that we have to make more of?
You see, Cheryl, it is not you who are following in our footsteps. It's the other way around. It is we that have to keep making new weapons just because you have developed something new, not the other way around, my friend. It is the United States, after all, that was the first to make the atom bomb and use it. It was the first to make nuclear subs with rockets. It was the United States that was the first to equip the rockets on these submarines with MIRV warheads. It was the first to start work on arming its long-range bombers with dozens of cruise missiles. Today, it is again the first to start all this talk about the neutron bomb. So you see, it is unfortunately the United States and its allies that stimulate the arms race and makes us constantly counter something that they had done. Our policy is not aimed at either the first or the second strikes, Cheryl. It's aimed at preventing war as such. Today we are ready for the most radical and far-reaching measures, including general and complete disarmament, under strict international control, that is. We are also ready to agree to partial measures, and there is no type of weapon on which we are not ready to come to an agreement. If we were what you say we are, Cheryl, or if we did what you say we're doing, certainly it would not be on our initiative that so many international agreements had already been signed.
And now a question from Anita Stover of Monroe, North Carolina. How do you choose which students will go to universities?
We choose the student with the highest marks at the competitive entrance exams, as I've already said. That is the only criteria, and the student himself decides on what university he wants to go to.
Approximately, how long does it take a worker to buy his weekly groceries?
In one of the previous shows, Anita, I explained in great detail that unfortunately we spend more time than you do in North Carolina to buy things at a supermarket because very often after we've selected the products we want, we have to stand in long lines at the cashiers because of bad organization in the stores. Sometimes there is a lack of this or that consumer item or product because of bad planning. I'll have to admit that.
The next question comes from John Brush of Cecil, Ohio. Are there any amusement parks for the Soviet people?
If you mean the Coney Island type, you know, with Ferris wheels and roller coasters and these machines that gyrate in the most awful manner, something teenagers like, yes, we have that type of park, not only in Moscow, but in other cities too. I personally prefer the type of park where you can enjoy the rustle of the leaves, the landscape, and the quiet. I don't know why, maybe it's age.
And there we end today's mailbag. If you want Joe Adamov to answer your question, Address your letters to the North American Service, Radio Moscow, Moscow, the USSR.